Good afternoon. You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher, and this is the second episode in our series on critical health issues. Today, we'll talk about the difference between calories from one kind of food to the next. Turns out there's a big one.
There's growing evidence that it's better to have 600 or 700 calories of healthier food than to have 500 calories of unhealthy food.
And we'll hear about how Clif Bar is trying to make it easier for college graduates to grow food for a living, especially if those would-be farmers want to take advantage of a booming market.
Organic is growing like crazy at the retail level, but organic acreage on the ground is not growing to meet that demand.
That's coming up on Spotlight Health. Not all calories are created equal, especially if there's a lot of food processing going on. That's one of the conclusions by researcher and cardiologist Dariush Muzaffarian. He's dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University in Boston. I asked Muzaffarian about his work looking at how different foods affect us, and if you have a sneaking suspicion that carbs are a part of this conversation, you're right.
The current conventional wisdom has been that all calories are the same, that if you have 100 calories from any source, it's equally relevant for risk of weight gain. And I think that there's growing evidence that that's just not true. It's better to have 600 or 700 calories of healthier food than to have 500 calories of unhealthy food. And you know, the reasons for that are that the human body is not just a bucket with a hole at the top and a hole at the bottom that you're kind of pouring calories in and they're being burned and calories are coming out the bottom. We're really complex creatures, and the different types of foods we eat influence our brains, our hunger, our gut bacteria, called the microbiome, our hormonal responses, our glucose responses, in so many complex ways that, while of course in a test tube every calorie is the same, in our bodies different foods don't have the same effect. And so we need to move away from this calorie idea toward, a concept of, how the foods actually influence our long-term unconscious behaviors and bodies' mechanisms for weight control.
Which I think brings us to the term glycemic load. What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, so glycemic load is one of the factors that could determine how a food influences a person's body and health and weight. And, what the glycemic load means is extent of rise in blood sugar for any amount of intake of a food. So, for example, if you eat a bagel, within seconds, the chains of starch in your mouth are digested to glucose, and within minutes in your stomach, a bagel is digested to almost free glucose. And so you get a big burst, a big rise in blood sugar, which is almost equivalent to table sugar. So really having Skittles candy or a refined breakfast cereal or a bagel or white rice gives you almost the same glycemic rush in your bloodstream. And so it has a high glycemic load. In contrast, fruit or steel-cut oats or beans, foods that are more intact and take a longer time to digest, they might have the same amount of carbohydrate and same amount of sugar in them, but that release into the bloodstream is much, much slower. And so that glycemic burst, that sugar burst into the bloodstream is lower. And that has lots of consequences for production of fat in the liver, which is harmful, for spikes in insulin, which are harmful, for brain unconscious craving, which is harmful. So, generally speaking, foods that have higher glycemic load that cause a big burst in blood sugar seem to be more adverse for diabetes and weight gain and cardiovascular diseases.
Is there a way to describe what might be going on there? You mentioned the foods that are a little more intact. Is there a way to describe what's going on in terms of fiber? Like, is it that foods that are more intact, as you said, have their own naturally occurring fiber or more of it, and that's kind of extending the glycemic load to a certain degree?
So, this is one of the, current questions and challenges in nutrition is how to best define a healthy carbohydrate. And, carbohydrates are about 50% of the food supply, and we don't want to just say low carb because fruits and beans and other foods that have carbs are quite good for you. So it's really the quality of the carbohydrate that's important. And the challenge is here is that you can, you know, alter the characteristics of a carbohydrate in different ways. And so, for example, you could take a grain like, or you could take oats, and you can make whole oats, and they have all the fiber, and finely mill them and make, you know, Cheerios or some other cereal. It has all the fiber, but it's finely milled, and so still the body's enzymes get to the sugars and the starch in that oat very quickly, and you still have a pretty quick glycemic response. In contrast, if you have steel-cut oats, which you have to cook for 45 minutes on the stove, and that same intact, partially intact food structure limits the body's ability to get enzymes in there to digest the starch, slowing down the release of sugar into the bloodstream. And so it's not really about fiber per se. It's more about how processed and how finely milled the product is. So it's a combination of the amount of starch, the amount of fiber, how finely processed it is, and then finally also whether it's solid or liquid, because it seems that, you know, calorie for calorie, people respond differently to 200 calories of sugar in a drink versus 200 calories of sugar in a solid food. So there's all of these complexities. I mean, at the end of the day, too much starch, too much sugar that's rapidly digested seems to be harmful. And, you know, in contrast, starch or sugars that are slowly digested and in smaller doses seem to be fine.
Yeah, and it seems like your work is right in the thick of research showing that diet snacks like Wheat Thins, low-fat yogurt, I feel like, you know, I saw ads for those all over the place through the 1990s and into the 2000s. Now there's a growing shift away from that. Maybe that's not the best way to diet or stay in shape, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it does seem that yogurt is healthy, but it may not be the fat content that's important. It may be the probiotics in the yogurt that interact with your gut bacteria, and that positive interaction, you know, leads to changes in the body that are helpful. So the fat content of the yogurt may be irrelevant. It may have more to do with the probiotics. I think what we're learning is even though two-thirds of Americans are still trying to avoid fat to be healthy and to lose weight, you know, the fat content of foods isn't a very useful predictor, high or low, of whether a food is healthy or not. You could have a food that's very high in fat, like nuts, that are incredibly good for you, and you could have a food that's very low in fat, like a bagel or white bread or most crackers, that are bad for you because of all the starch, the refined starch. So I think what we're learning is that, you know, we have to consider more than just the fat content of a food to understand its health effects. And probably the simplest rule would be to have foods that are, you know, less processed. You can't say unprocessed because most foods need some processing to be consumed, but to have foods that are less processed and lower in starch and sugar in particular. And, you know, if you had to come up with kind of a rule of thumb, it would be sort of the traditional Mediterranean diet. You know, lots of healthy vegetable oils, fruits, vegetables, nuts, fish, and minimally processed whole grains like stone ground bread or other not finely milled whole grains. And then, you know, again, avoiding all of the heavily refined, processed, and packaged breads and breakfast cereals and energy bars that in the past have been billed as healthy because they're low fat.
There's already a shift against carbs, as I'm sure you well know, and especially a growing interest in being gluten-free. Do you think that's a shift in a healthier direction, given what we've discussed?
So I think the low carbohydrate focus is partially correct. It's partially correct because, on average, the carbohydrates in the modern world are refined starch and sugars, white rice, white bread, breakfast cereals, crackers, energy bars, lots of other sugars that are harmful. And so moving away from those is very healthy because it reduces weight gain, diabetes, and likely cardiovascular disease. On the other hand, it's only partially correct because carbohydrate itself is not necessarily harmful. It depends on the dose and how rapidly that dose is digested by the body. So fruit, for example, beans, for example, that have dairy, you know, for example, that has some carbohydrate, but that carbohydrate is in a lower dose and isn't as rapidly digested, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And so people should be eating fruit and beans and not worrying about, for example, the naturally occurring carbohydrate in milk or other products. So I think, you know, low carb, again, is mostly right just because of how bad most of the carbohydrate is in the modern food supply. But, you know, people don't need to go carb-free or go on sort of the original strict Atkins diet, which they've also, you know, modified to be more permissive about fruit and other healthy sources of carbohydrate.
I'm curious, did you have a hunch going into this area of research saying, I have a feeling that carbs may be a little overblown and that the low-fat diet isn't working? Was it something like that, or was it more kind of a technical detail that pushed you in that direction?
So I'm a cardiologist, and, you know, early in my, you know, medical training, more than 20 years ago, it was obvious to me that, you know, diet was the single biggest factor influencing my patient's health. And, you know, we didn't learn very much about diet outside biochemistry in medical school. And so I started looking at the science myself, and I realized that even 20 years ago, the prevailing guidelines to focus on low-fat foods weren't strongly supported by the evidence. And so I was sort of struck that here we have the biggest health problem facing our country. It's not addressed in the medical system, and even the current guidelines 20 years ago, which were all focused on low fat, you know, didn't fit the science even 20 years ago. And so, you know, I don't have any skin in the game for what the science shows. I want to understand, you know, what is the best evidence-based advice we can give to people and to industry to make a healthier food system. And so I think we've learned a lot, and we've come a long way. And one of the things we've learned is that, you know, poor quality carbohydrates, refined starch and sugars in particular, both are harmful for modern life.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk.
Delighted to talk, and I look forward to being in Aspen.
Dariush Muzaffarian is Dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University in Boston. This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. Spotlight Health is our six-part series on top current health issues. To keep up with this and other Aspen Public Radio shows, like Mountain Edition or Curated, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Farmers in the U.S. are aging, with not enough new young growers joining the ranks. Clif Bar & Company, yes, the makers of that iconic energy bar, are hoping to make it easier for more young folks to make a living raising crops or livestock. Matthew Dillon is the company's director of agricultural policy and programs and explains the challenge this way.
Many young farmers face financial obstacles when it comes to trying to start their own farming operations. And there's certainly the cost of land can be very prohibitive, machinery. There's a kind of a learning curve to getting up and economically viable. But in a recent survey that was done by the National Young Farmer Coalition, student loans was ranked as one of the top obstacles that young farmers face in being able to start their own farming operations. We as a nation really need these young farmers to move into the profession of farming. We have an aging agricultural population. The average age of the American farmer is now at 58.3 years. And so in order to incentivize more young farmers to go into farming, we are supporting a National Young Farmer Coalition piece of legislation that basically be a loan forgiveness program. It's called the Young Farmer Success Act. And it's similar to, say, someone coming out of medical school or getting a degree in education, where if they move into communities that are in need of doctors or teachers, There's a pathway for them to get some of their student loan debt forgiven by the federal government for doing service that has a public good. And we think farming is a public good, and that moving more young farmers into that profession is something that should be rewarded, just as doctors and teachers are rewarded.
And I'm sure that this was something where there were several stories that led to the proposed legislation, but is there one in particular? It was an experience that you had or that you're aware of that jump-started the conversation?
Well, for me, I certainly, my own personal experiences got me interested in Clif Bar supporting this, and that I come from an agricultural family, a conventional agricultural family in Nebraska. I watched as land prices became prohibitive and as the agricultural sector became a challenge, and my family did not want me to continue on in farming and agriculture because they just didn't think it was economically viable, especially after getting a college degree. In our own supply chain at Clif Bar, we have been spending time going out and talking with farmers, letting them tell their stories to us. And over, this is one of the stories that we hear, is that the transition of agricultural land to the next generation is a challenge. And that the farmers themselves, the aging farming population, are concerned about this. And they think we all need to be working collectively on a pathway forward. I think one of the reasons that I really like it is, while there's a lot of tension in the food movement, I mean, people talk a lot about food fights, and there's debates about types of agriculture, what's best for the planet and for feeding people. Across the board, doesn't matter what type of agricultural system you support, this is something we all agree on, is that we have to address the aging farmer population. And it's great to work on something that in which we all agree, in the political climate, which that's often a challenge.
Yeah, do you find that you're able to have conversations with people who normally may have shied away from being available?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think it's telling that so far for the 6S Act, the representative from New York, Chris Gibson, who initially sponsored it, is a Republican, and there has been strong both Republican and Democratic sponsorship for the legislation. So that's always a good sign when those two sides can get together. And we've talked about this with conventional food companies and agricultural companies, and it's, again, something that across the board folks really are supportive of. And they see this issue of the aging farming population in rural America as being something that has to be addressed if we're not going to just outsource all of our agriculture to the globe, which is not a good idea.
You know, I looked at a Clif Bar in the back of my car earlier today, and I'm realizing I am not really aware of what, like, the top three ingredients are. So may I ask, what kinds of farmers are you talking to?
Well, the Clif Bar supply chain is really very interesting. It's one of the reasons I was excited to come work here. It's a very complicated supply chain. We have, for example, over 140 different organic ingredients alone that we use for all of our different bar categories. And those come from about 50 to 60 different crop types. But here in the United States and North America, you know, the key crops for us would be oats, soy, nuts, fruit. Those are really the key ingredients that would be grown in here in the United States. Obviously, we also use chocolate and ingredients such as that, but those would not be impacted by this legislation.
And so what's at stake for Clif Bar if that difficulty in young farmers joining the workforce or staying in the workforce, what's at stake for your company if that isn't helped along a bit?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways that we look at this. Clif Bar is a company that, instead of having a single bottom line or even triple bottom line, we're a five aspiration company. We have five aspirations by which we measure our success, and business and brand are two of those, but then we also have people, planet, and community. And I actually, as the Director of Agriculture Policy and Programs, work on the community team. And it is our belief that any decisions that we make when it comes to agriculture must first look at the impact that those decisions have on the well-being of rural communities, those communities' resiliency, and their ability to succeed and grow and improve. So this Young Farmer Success Act, really, we see it through this lens of our community aspiration, even more than kind of the business supply chain approach. We think that we, as a company that relies on rural communities, relies on successful farming operations, we have a commitment to support those rural communities in any way we possibly can. you know, whether it's paying more for organic ingredients so that those farms can be economically more viable, whether it's investing in research that's going to benefit those rural communities, or it's funding and advocating for legislation such as this that would give the sons and daughters of rural America a more direct and easier pathway into farming as a profession.
You've been listening to Matthew Dillon with Cliff Bar & Company. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to Spotlight Health from Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher, and if you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a full version on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Let's continue our conversation with Matthew Dillon, Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Cliff Bar & Company in the San Francisco Bay Area. Is it possible that for you guys, your product wouldn't be possible in like 20 years if more farmers don't get into the game?
Yeah, so you're bringing up an interesting point. And one of the things that we're seeing is that when it comes to organic ingredients, which is, you know, we're a company that uses 75% of the ingredients we use across all brands are certified organic, and we every year commit to using more and more to work our way to 100%. One of the things we see is that more and more young farmers are interested in organic, so supporting young farmers does also help us with that aspiration of trying to achieve greater organic acreage and improve our organic supply chain. And it is a challenge. I mean, right now in the United States, organic is growing like crazy at the retail level, but organic acreage on the ground is not growing to meet that demand. And so more and more companies are having to look globally for crops and ingredients. And I will give you an example from our own supply. I mean, we use a lot of oats. We're probably one of the biggest users of organic oats in the world, maybe the biggest. I believe we probably are. And we source most of those oats from Canada and the U.S., where they grow very, very well. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we've had to actually buy oats from Northern Europe in order to meet our demand. We can't buy enough oats from Canada and the U.S. Now, oats from Scandinavia are not cheaper than U.S. oats by a long shot, and you also have to pay for the shipping of those oats over. So that is certainly a potential benefit for our company, is that if we can encourage more farmers, young farmers, to move into farming as a profession, there's a high probability some of those farmers are going to be interested in organic, because the data shows that a lot of young farmers are open and interested in organic.
I see. So it's not that you see a danger in losing enough of product to be able to buy. Basically, it's more that keeping as much of that stateside as possible.
Yeah, I mean, again, given the type of ingredients we use, like, again, the oats, the almonds, figs that are grown here domestically, we certainly want to have those rural communities continue to thrive and succeed and be able to grow those crops.
You've been passionate about seed banking for a while. Why is that a critical issue?
I used to be a farmer myself, and as a farmer, I recognized that the seed I used really had an important role in the success of my farming operation. If I wasn't using the right seed for my soils, my climate, my environment, the markets I was trying to serve, I was less likely to succeed. If I used the wrong seed as a farmer, you might be more susceptible to a disease. You might have seed that isn't as good at getting nutrients out of the soil or out-competing weeds. So farmers really have to use the seed that works best for their environments, their local environments, as well as their markets, what their consumers want. We currently have a seed industry that is really controlled by a small handful of companies. There are, you know, four companies that control about 60% of the world's seed supply. And those companies serve a fairly narrow market. They're looking at providing seed to the very largest industrial agricultural production operations in the world. That's where they make their most profit and are the most efficient. So it makes sense that that's just simply who they serve. Now, people can read whatever they want into that. You can think about, oh, that's a conspiracy. You know, there's lots of fear around that. But just from a farm basic reality, farmers need seed that is going to fit their environments. And if this concentrated seed market is not meeting those needs, we need to figure out how to meet those. Seed conservation, seed banking, is essential for developing healthy and robust regional seed systems. A healthy seed system is a combination of good conservation of crop genetics, of seed, combined with doing crop improvement, plant breeding, selection, to develop varieties that work well for your environment, your region, and your markets. So through Clif Bar Family Foundation and Clif Bar, we've been supporting a number of projects, both seed conservation projects as well as plant breeding projects at our public land grant universities that will help farmers get the seed they need, as well as gardeners. We recognize that farming is very important, but a lot of us also get our food from home gardens, urban gardens, school gardens, and that's a trend that's going to increase. So part of the investment we've made has been in supporting community seed libraries at public libraries all around the country. There's some there in Colorado, in fact. And it's a neat movement that we're proud to support and encourage to grow.
You know, I asked this about the other topic. What's at stake if there isn't a greater diversity, but also, for lack of a better word, kind of banking system for seeds? Ultimately, what's the worst thing that could happen?
When it comes to food security and our ability to feed ourselves, a sense of urgency is important. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that seed is the foundation for food security. Again, if farmers don't have seed that works well for their environment and is able to fight off diseases, pests, you can have catastrophic failures. The potato blight of Ireland in the 19th century is a great example of not having enough genetic diversity in the field. And then having a disease like blight that caused massive crop losses and then hunger and starvation, as well as social chaos that comes with that. In our modern era, we've had diseases like southern corn blight that in the 1970s wiped out 20-30% of the U.S. corn yield and, again, created global market problems and hunger issues, as well as huge losses for rural communities. Given climate change, what we're seeing is that there are more and more microepidemics happening across the country where diseases that were never seen before are moving into new regions. And one of the key ways to combat the risks of these new disease epidemics that are occurring is to have adequate crop genetic diversity. Seed banks are our safety net. They're the well of rich diversity that plant breeders go to in order to find resistance to a new disease, like rust or like blight.
Well, Matthew Dillon, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thank you, Elise. Really appreciate it. It's been enjoyable.
Matthew Dillon is Director of Agricultural Policy and Programs at Clif Bar & Company. That's all for our second Spotlight Health episode. If you like the music you're hearing behind me right now, check out The Reflex on SoundCloud. You can listen to this and our following Spotlight Health episodes on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.